You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
All right, class, stop typing, please. Before we go on with the next exercise, I'd like to make one of my little speeches.
Welcome to episode 209 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by Richard Kirkham from the Lambcast to discuss a 1971 film where the crooks are the good guys, starring Jimmy Stewart, George Kennedy, Strother Martin, and Kurt Russell, directed by Andrew V. McLaglen. It's Fool's Parade. But first...
This is a good time to remind you that you owe another obligation. To your health.
The Forgotten Filmcast
is the proper foundation for the activities of a busy day.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're happy to announce that we've installed Burns-O-Matic in-car heaters for your comfort and pleasure. When you receive your heater, you'll find it very easy to place in your car. Just roll down your front window and rest the heater's bracket on the window with the cylinder on the outside of the car. Roll up your window securely as far as it will go to hold the heater firmly in position. For maximum results, tilt the face of the heater towards the windshield and sit back and enjoy the show in healthful comfort. With these modern, safe, efficient in-car heaters, this drive-in theater will now remain open all year round. If you have any further questions about your Burns-O-Matic in-car heater, please contact one of our theater attendants. And remember, this drive-in theater will now remain open all year round, regardless of the weather.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
it's Elvis as a singing, swinging cowboy. A rodeo riding, bronco busting champ. Oops. Whose job is wrangling fillies on a dude ranch, where the little girl with the big eyes is a cowboy's dream.
Such an easy question. Why can't I get an answer?
The ranch boss, a gal who usually gets what she wants.
I thought this was going to be strictly business.
Oh, I mean business.
I've heard of this happening to secretaries before, but this is ridiculous.
We're going to love our whole life long. Call baby, it feels all right. How can it be wrong?
When Elvis sings, dude ranch dolls drool. But their buckaroos are spoiling for a fight. Leave it to Elvis to find a ghost town with real live ghosts.
What'd I tell you?
It's your imagination. It's no use, Pam. He's too smart for us.
He's a hard-hitting hombre, and the kind of guy that brings a ghost town to life.
The Panhandle Kid.
You just did what I made you do. You love me and I love you too. So if the way they talk can bother you, I put the blame on me.
Is it all real? Or is it a dream?
Since you stole her out of sight, I had a peaceful night. Night Rider, won't you let my baby be? Come on, send her back to me.
And now, on with the show.
Kind of foggy out there today. I imagine it'll all burn off by 10, 11 o'clock. Oh, are you, Mr. Grindstaff, the man made out this check? Good, good. I'm awful happy to hear that because you're the man that's going to cash it. Don't do that!
Sit down, counsel.
Now, Mr. Grindstaff, these are various lengths of Ensign Bickford's safety fuse.
Fuse?
Fuse, that's right. And they're tied in with these. Well, it's what's next to my heart, you might say.
What's that?
Well, it's just what you're looking at, Mr. Grindstaff. At 12 sticks of DuPont high-velocity gelatin dynamite. And 12 mercury fulminite dynamite caps. I reckon that ought to do it. Don't you think so, Mr. Grindstaff?
Is this your way of sticking up a bank?
No. No. No, I'm not a bank robber. I'm just an American that's come into a bank to cash a check.
I'll see you in hell first.
Well, that's very possible, Mr. Grindstaff. Very, very possible indeed. And sooner than you think if you don't get me my money right quick. Now, Captain Counsel. No. Some of these fuses here are short burning. And if you don't sit back down there and stay there, I'm going to light one of them. And when I do, you can start counting to five, but you'll never get there. Because between two and four, this office and this bank and half this city block will just go to kingdom come. I got 60 more pounds of it in here. A bag of blasting powder must have busted. Spilled all over the dynamite. Look at that.
For God's sake, man, watch your smokes.
Well, now, you want to go into the vault and get me my money right quick?
I'm warning you, Apple Yard, this is a crime you won't get away with.
Well, I'll go along with you on that, Mr. Grindstaff.
Suicide's one crime you can say that about. It's also one crime nobody ever got locked up for.
Suicide?
Don't you understand? Don't you really see what I'm getting at? If I don't get my money, it's going to make me feel so sad and depressed, I don't think I'd really be interested in living anymore.
Are you trying to tell me that you intend on blowing yourself up?
Me and you and Captain Council and 50 or 60 innocent people in the immediate vicinity.
I think you're a liar. Counsel, do you think he means it?
In my best judgment, Mr. Grindstaff, he does.
All right, I'll give you your money. Can you stop that thing? Whee!
Okay, our movie this time is Fool's Parade from 1971. And joining me to discuss this film is Richard Kirkham from the Lambcast. Richard, welcome back to the show.
What we've got here is an evitory.
Somehow I knew you were going to channel Strother Martin on this show at some point. It's inevitable, yes.
I guess so.
Well, it is great to have you back on this show. You are one of my most frequent guests, and that is because we go way back. We'll get more into that here in a minute. Before we get too far into things, take a moment, tell everybody a bit about who you are and what you do.
All right. Well, I've been a blogger for 12 years now. No, 14 years now. I should learn to count. I started in 2010. My site is Kirkham A Movie A Day. My original project was doing exactly that, posting on a movie every day, but that only lasted 3 months. The following 14 years have just been intermittent posts, although last year I had quite a few. It was almost every day, not quite, every other day or every third day, I think it was, if you averaged it all out. I'm also the host of a weekly podcast, The Lambcast, which you have been a frequent guest on, even before I was the host. I'm kind of a legacy host, as they say. I've inherited this job from several other people over the years, and I just recently took over control of the whole Lamb site, so it should all fall apart in the next couple of months pretty easily.
I don't think that'll happen, but no. Well, since you brought it up, I mean, this is as good a time as any to tell everybody a bit about the Lamb. Large Association of Movie Blogs. I don't want to miss those opportunities to promote it because I got to admit, what got me going when it comes to podcasting and connecting me with an awful lot of the people that I have on the show is the relationships, the friendships that have come about through this organization. So please tell us all about the Lamb.
Well, the LAM is the largest association of online movie blogs with over 2,000 members. I can't say that all 2,000 members are active. In fact, when it comes to the podcast, probably less than 100 of them are active. We have a number of people who participate regularly, but believe me, I'm not getting thousands of requests to be on the podcast. That would make filling the show each week a lot easier. But we are trying to keep the site pretty active. Right now, the only posts that are going up are things that are generated by the Lambcast, which is our podcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs. But we're going to try and add a few things in the next few months, try and keep the site going. There is, of course, a long history of content there. How much is accessible, how much has gone away over the years, I couldn't say for sure. I do know that some of the podcasts are not accessible anymore, but most of them are still available to people. And I know everything since I took over is still available on our sites, so you should be able to find lots of things for your entertainment value. Of course, I'm not charging anything, so that might tell you how much it's worth.
Well, I mean, I think it's worth a lot because, like I said, I have Met a lot of great people, made a lot of great connections through the Lambcast and the various other things that go on there. And I appreciate you keeping that podcast going and coming up with all the topics and things. And I admit there are certain ones that I always tend to gravitate towards because they're just in my wheelhouse more than other things. But that's one of the great things about the show is that there's always a variety of things going on. My favorites that you do here in recent years, Richard, are where you focus on a certain movie year and we get to come and talk about our favorite movies from that year.
Yes, we've got another look back episode coming in the next 2 months, so I'm sure that you'll be signing up for that. Hopefully other people will as well. Let me just say that the 1960s was a rich era for film, and there is a pivotal year in that decade that we are going to be talking about.
Ah, excellent. Well, I'm very much looking forward to it. Now, speaking of those years, I mean, I was thinking about it today that this year marks 10 years that you and I have known each other, been podcasting together.
That's right.
Because we first connected when I was doing a series on my blog, and then it carried over to my podcast, where we were focusing on the movies of 1984, and you were kind of doing the same thing. The first time I had you on the podcast was when we were focusing on 84. We talked about City Heat with Clint Eastwood and Burt Reynolds, which is not one of the best films of 84, but no. I mean, you know, it was fun to talk about.
We were both looking at a lot of films from 1984. The title, the name of my blog that for that particular project was 30 Years On. If I go back and write on it now, it's 40 Years On. Holy criminy, time is flying.
I know.
1984 was a great year for movies, and we've talked about it a number of times. There are just a lot of pivotal movies from our generation that came out in 1984.
And we're getting that nostalgia again this year because Ghostbusters is my favorite movie of 84 and one of my favorite movies of all time. And we get a new Ghostbusters movie here in a few weeks. So that is exciting, of course. Now, I know that you have focused on the various movie years at different times. I know last year you were doing some stuff with 1975. Today we're in the 70s. And I know when I was pitching to you coming back on the show and asked you to suggest some films you might want to talk about, you've zoned right in on 70 and 71. So are you in like those first couple of years of the 70s mood right now? Is that the years that you're fixating on?
You know, I've kind of been obsessed with the 70s ever since I started, you know, broadcasting and writing and blogging. That's the period that I grew up in. In 1970, I was 12 years old, so I'm, you know, just hitting my peak of being able to go to the movies by myself. This year, I'm not exactly sure if I'm going to start another project for a particular year, but I did think that I would kind of stick to the early 70s for any side projects that I do. And I've been updating the Strother Martin film project, and of course, he was very active in the 1970s, so it's likely that 1970s films are going to make up some of the content on my site this year.
Well, I definitely wasn't getting to the movies the year that this movie was released because I was born in 71, so I wasn't a frequent moviegoer yet. But yeah, before we get to this movie, you mentioned Strother Martin. He's in this film. We've talked about other Strother Martin films when I've had you on the podcast before because I know that he is a favorite of yours. You have a personal connection. So why don't you share that here first before we start talking about this movie?
All right. Yes. Well, I'm happy to share that. Strother Martin was my mother's cousin. He lived with my mother and her family for several months back when he was going to college in Michigan, and they lived in Michigan at the time. And so it was one of those things where my grandmother was basically his favorite aunt. And the family all called him Jay. I don't know where the nickname came from, but I always referred to him as Jay as well. And I met him when I was a kid. He passed away in 1980, the day before I got married. And he and his wife were supposed to come down for the wedding. And my mother did not tell me that he had died. She knew and didn't tell me. She didn't want to overshadow the day. We weren't close. I mean, we probably saw him every 3 or 4 years for dinner or something like that. But he was somebody that my mother had very fond memories of and a pretty good relationship with. You know, Christmas cards and occasional phone calls, that kind of thing.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I admit, I wasn't too familiar with him until these last 10 years where you and I have gotten to know each other and interact. And in that time, I keep seeing him show up in movies and going, oh, he's so much fun to see in film. So we'll get more into that in a moment here. Let's talk about this movie we have today. It's called Fool's Parade from 1971, directed by a director named Andrew V. McLaglen. He was a British director, worked in both TV and movies, primarily known for directing westerns, especially ones starring John Wayne or Jimmy Stewart. Among the films he directed in that genre, Chisholm, McClintock, Shenandoah, Cahill, U.S. Marshal. So he had a couple of big guns in his westerns, so to speak.
Don't forget, his father was Victor McLaughlin.
Yeah. He had a number of other films in other genres over the years. As I was looking through his filmography, I noticed the Disney film Monkeys Go Home, which is not with the band The Monkees. It's just got a bunch of monkeys in it. And he directed Mitchell, starring Joe Don Baker, which is famously the last episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000 with Joel, where he leaves the show and then Mike comes on and takes over. Mitchell was the movie they talked about on that one.
Mitchell was a film that I hadn't seen before, and I did cover it last year on my project when I was doing Throwback Thursdays for 1975. So
excellent.
It's I understand a little bit why it ended up on Mystery Science Theater.
Now, we should also mention that this film is based on a novel by Davis Grubb. And he, if you look through the other things he wrote, there's one that jumps right out there to movie fans. He wrote Night of the Hunter. I don't know about the book, but the movie is incredible. So,
the movie's fantastic, yeah.
Yes, it's quite a film. But apparently, when they shot this film, they filmed it in the areas of West Virginia where Davis Grubb was originally from, and he based the locations on that. So this movie really went back to the source material as far as the locales where they shot it. Now, this film, it centers on three men just released from prison. We have Matty Appleyard, played by Jimmy Stewart. He's got a glass eye and has spent the last 40 years in prison for murder. Then we have a bank robber, Lee Contrell, played by Strother Martin. And then the youngster of the group, Johnny, played by Kurt Russell, a very young Kurt Russell.
He's just a kid. He looks so small and young.
He was on loan from his Disney contract during this, for sure, because basically all of his movies before this and several after this are all with Uncle Walt. So these three have been released from prison, a prison in a place called Glory, West Virginia. And as they are released, they are accompanied to the train station by the prison captain, a guy named Doc Counsel, played by George Kennedy. And he aims to make sure that they leave town. He doesn't want any of the ex-cons that are released from this prison to just stay in Glory. He just wants to make sure that they move on and don't pollute the town with their presence. He's also not too thrilled about the fact that Appleyard has in his possession a check for $25,000. Now, you see, Appleyard saved up all his earnings during 4 years in prison, and now he and his two cohorts plan to take that money and open a general store. Now, the thing is, this is during the Great Depression, so council and basically everybody else doesn't see it as very fair that a bunch of ex-cons should have all that money while everyone else is struggling. Now, Council actually has more nefarious plans because he's in cahoots with the manager of the bank that issued the check, played by the Big Lebowski himself, David Huddleston. And they arrange for a couple of killers, including one who has a taste for killing specifically atheists, to meet the three cons further down the tracks and make sure that they don't get the chance to settle anywhere. Okay, they're gonna wipe these guys out. Now, midway through the train trip, though, Appleyard realizes that the check he has can only be cashed at the bank that issued it back in Glory. So the three ex-cons make their way back to town, and Appleyard has to pull off a bizarre plot to get the check cashed that feels a bit like a robbery, but really isn't. We'll talk more about that as we go, I'm sure. And then the three have to try and make their way out of Glory before being caught by Council. But that, of course, proves to be more difficult than they could have ever imagined. So this is one of those films that is categorized as a crime drama, but most of the crime that's going on in this film is not being done by the criminals, by the ex-cons. But I'm going to let Richard get us started here. Give us a few of your thoughts on Fool's Parade.
Well, I think the most obvious thing that always jumps out at me is that it's kind of a reversal of the roles that George Kennedy and Strother Martin had from Cool Hand Luke, where Strother Martin was the captain of the prison, and he was the one who had the prisoners under his thumb, not with any financial corruption, but certainly with a sadistic attitude about how the prisoners are supposed to behave. And George Kennedy, of course, is one of the prisoners. He becomes Paul Newman's buddy in the prison camp there. And this is the exact opposite of that. Now, George Kennedy is the captain of the prison, and he is corrupt as all hell. And Strother Martin is playing one of the prisoners, and he's a kind of feckless character, which is a part that Strother played on a pretty regular basis. He was either a conniving kind of character that had something, some sort of subterfuge behind him, or he was guileless and kind of a simpleton. Those were very typical parts that he played in these films. And this movie is, to me, it's a very straightforward late 60s, early 70s drama. It doesn't have a lot of bells and whistles to it. It tells a pretty straightforward story. It's done in a very functional way. It looks good. I think they spent time and energy getting a couple of things right. They get the train right. For the most part, they've got the cars right. The look of the town is about right. The feel of the movie is good. I think the interactions between the three characters are fine. I think that Kurt Russell doesn't really get a chance to do much in the first two-thirds of the film, and in the third act, he gets kind of a romantic interest to follow up on and give him a little bit more cachet in the film. The standout in the film, though, is definitely George Kennedy, who is just
absolutely yeah.
reprehensible. You know, he is the most hypocritical Sunday school teacher you could ever imagine, and he's not only a conniving person, he's a bit of a sadist too. So it's just, and he hires a couple of contract killers that he apparently has used before. He's a regular murderer. You know, there's not a secret about it from the audience. We discover early on that he's committed a whole variety of crimes in basically working in cahoots with the bank manager for who knows what other kinds of deals. He's got a regular guy that he works with when he needs to kill people. And if you've got a regular guy, you know, there's something bad going on.
Yeah. Like, you're pretty much reading from my notes here, Richard. You just hit a bunch of things that are right what I was thinking. This film, I enjoyed it quite a bit. It was a very nice surprise. I admit this is one that I was not aware of at all until you suggested it. And I thought, well, that looks intriguing. Let's check it out. And of course, the thing that grabs me right off the bat with this is, you know, right from the very beginning, okay, the opening credits are rolling. We've got these four characters that are being driven to the train station, and they set the mood very nicely. There's great, you know, 30s era music playing over the opening credits, and the town and all that, you know, looks the part. We'll talk more about that in a bit here. But just these four people sitting in this car, I'm like, right there in front of me are four people that when I see them on a movie screen, I'm automatically intrigued. You know, Jimmy Stewart, George Kennedy, Strother Martin, and Kurt Russell. I'm like,
I'd see that movie.
All right, lay it on me. You know what? Lay it on me. I want to see what these guys are going to do. And I think you hit on something very important there where, you know, you basically were saying, you know, this movie is very simple. It's not got a lot of flash to it. You know, it's not going to, you know, give you, you know, much in terms of a wow moment. There's maybe one or two wow moments, but, you know, it's a very straightforward and simple story that plays out in a very organic way. And it takes its time, though it's not a terribly long movie. I guess you could say the story meanders a bit, but that's the nature of the story. It's these guys who are struggling to get out of town and, you know, start a new life for themselves. And yet, for as kind of meandering as the story is, I found myself just really drawn in. And I think part of that is that they really just paint a wonderful picture of all these characters. I was just immediately intrigued to see what was going to happen to them.
Yeah, and there are a variety of secondary characters that make the main characters even more interesting by comparison.
Absolutely, yeah.
William Wyndham is an actor that I remember from a TV show that was based on James Thurber. And I'm trying to remember what the name of the show was. But it was about a comic book artist or a comic artist. He didn't write comic books, but I think he wrote or drew comics for magazines and that sort of thing. And I'm trying to remember the name of the show, and I can't remember it. But I watched that in the 1960s, and I kind of liked him as a character. And I remember him from an episode of Star Trek. And I saw him frequently in movies over the years, including at the beginning of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, where he basically doesn't have any script, at least not any dialogue, So he just hums and haws his way through the film. And he has the part here of a salesman that they run into on the train out of town who is, he's not particularly on the straight and narrow. He's engaged in some activity that is probably illegal and dangerous, but he's not a criminal per se. He's just skirting the law, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of an obnoxious guy who comes along and just starts. He's the one who creates a lot of the exposition because he starts asking questions.
Right.
There's a conductor on the train who is basically been paid off to participate in this setup of the three guys on the train by the captain. And he gets cold feet. He feels bad about the kid being one of the targets. He tries to scare them off. And he comes up two or three times in the story later on because all he does is he rides the train back and forth between these two towns where they're trying to send the prisoners to get them out of town. And so I was surprised when I remembered seeing it, when I saw it. I watched it a year ago for one of my projects, and I remembered a little bit more this time how often that character is actually in the movie. And then the contract killers are a couple of oddballs that are – I don't know. They could have been in Diamonds Are Forever, The Replacement.
the one guy that's wearing the cowboy outfit that looks like something right out of a Roy Rogers movie or something like that.
Right. He's a country western singer, and he's supposed to do a radio show. But first, he's got to take his Winchester and kill some people on the train before he goes up and sings on the radio.
Yeah. Jumping back to the conductor, too, I really liked that character as well. The conductor is played by Robert Donner. And I couldn't have told you his name, but I'm looking at his face going, he's somebody. And then I realized, he was on Mork and Mindy. He played this character that showed up every now and then called Exidor. And he was kind of like this crazy guy that would talk to Mork all the time. And, I watched that show all the time as a kid. So I was suddenly like, I've seen those reruns a million times. But I mean, all these side characters, I mean, we'll get more into the leads. The leads are great characters. But one of the things I really liked about this movie is, like you were saying, there's all these side characters who come into the movie for little bits and pieces here and there. And we don't dwell on them, but we get enough to really be intrigued by these characters and go, you know what? I wouldn't mind seeing a whole other movie about that guy,
It would be interesting what's going on in this town with the banker and the madam.
Oh, yeah. Well, talking about some of my favorite, of the side characters, Ann Baxter as Cleo, this madam that is operating out of a houseboat. That scene was one of the standout scenes for me of the whole thing. She almost steals the movie away from George Kennedy for me there in that moment. And part of it, too, is not just her, but she's just got a wonderful back and forth with Strother Martin in that scene. I love that she's, you know, so garish looking and got the painted on eyebrows and looks almost, it's almost like clown makeup that she's got. It looks really bizarre. And she makes him take his hat off, out of respect for the flag that she has hanging on the wall. She's fiercely patriotic and she's holding this grudge against the Daughters of the American Revolution because they wouldn't let her join the organization because she runs a house of ill repute, you know? And I thought, what great little backstory we're getting about this character that's on screen for all of maybe 10 minutes.
Right. It's excellent. And there's some whimsical stuff in that section also, but I think there is a little bit of an issue with the tone because when it gets resolved, it's a lot darker than we might have hoped at the beginning of it.
Well, yeah, that's one of those wow moments I was hinting at earlier. Well, let's jump back to our main characters here because we kind of jumped over them. I mean, I think our four leads, all could deserve some comments here. So where do you want to start?
Well, Jimmy Stewart is the star. This is his last starring role in a movie. He was semi-retired after this from movies. He did appear in the John Wayne film, The Shootist, but he has a very small part in that. And he also did voice work in one of the American Tail movies. But other than those films, this was his last starring role where he was the lead character in the film. And I think he still got it. I think he was great. He's got a terrific scene where he confronts one of the killers on the train and flusters him with a bit of legerdemain and old Bible school tub thumping. And I thought that was a great sequence and it worked really well. Like I said, Kurt Russell is, you know, he's got a very quiet part for the most part. He's following around. He's a little bit of a fifth wheel, so to speak, although he is part of the main group. He's a lot more innocent. He's clearly the target of Doc Counsel's ire. I'm not exactly sure what's going on there, if it's just he's got something creepy about kids or his Bible study stuff. And he seems to go really off on the kid.
There's in that opening scene where George Kennedy has taken them to the train station and he says some things to Kurt Russell's character that, you know, indicate there was an incident with a girl, you know, like, you know, he says something about what you did to that girl or something like that. And you get the impression that it might not have been legit, you know, that what he's saying Kurt Russell did, he didn't actually do. I mean, part of it is you're looking at Kurt Russell's baby face there and going, really? Come on. I mean, actually, you're looking at all three of these guys and going, what could they have possibly done? Because, I mean, like, Jimmy Stewart killed somebody and spent 40 years in prison? Really? That's Jimmy Stewart, you know?
Yes. And, of course, later on, we discover the circumstances under which he was convicted of a crime. And most of us would probably recognize that it was an act of self-defense that led him to do what he was doing. And he certainly shouldn't have been in prison for 40 years. But, you know, that's not necessarily the way things work. The judicial system and law enforcement, let me see, we'd have to say that was in the 1890s when he got convicted because he was there for 40 years. Maybe it wasn't quite as forward-thinking and cautious about the rights of the accused as we might find in more recent times.
I agree that I thought Jimmy Stewart did a very good job in this. It's funny, as I looked through at some other people's thoughts on this film, I found far too many people got caught up in the glass eye and found the glass eye to be really distracting and all this, which I was like, okay, I get it. Because, you know, the first couple times you see it, you're going, wow, that looks really, really strange. And then there's some scenes where he actually is doing stuff with the eye, you know, and it's a little weird and all that stuff. But come on, folks, put that out of your mind. We're all grown-ups here. We can get beyond that weirdness. The performance, I think, is really good. And I you know, people talk about Jimmy Stewart and his folksy charm and you know, that whole thing. And I found that to be really interesting in the context of this role, where he is a guy that spent 40 years in prison. I love the scene where he goes back to the bank and it has a ton of dynamite strapped to him and he's going to cash the check. And, you know, he lays out this whole thing to David Huddleston and George Kennedy, you know, about how the dynamite works and the short fuse and all this. And it's just so funny hearing him describe all this stuff about how he's going to blow up a city block, you know, with him in it. But he's doing it with this, you know, just folksy drawl. And it's like sitting there listening to Grandpa, you know, tell some story or something.
Well, the connection that I, or the comparison I was thinking of is it feels a little bit like George Clooney in one of those heist movies, you know, that he did out of sight, for instance, where, you know, it's all chutzpah that he's getting by on. He can mm-hmm. talk himself into being in control in a situation and threaten people convincingly, even if he's not really going to do it. Although Jimmy Stewart really sells the idea, you know what? If I didn't get my money, what else do I have to live for?
Yeah, exactly. And I love in that scene too that he, you know, the woman, the teller from up front or whatever it is, brings him to the back office, and Huddleston and Kennedy are too busy talking to each other. They just ignore him. They're like, just a minute. They don't even notice that Jimmy Stewart's just standing there while they're laying out the plan for how they're going to kill him.
Exactly.
Yeah, and going back to Kurt Russell, I agree. I think he's, I don't want to say the most disappointing part of the film, because, you know, it was a treat seeing him here, seeing him so young and all that. But it's the one part of the story, the one part of the dynamic with these three guys that I felt was a bit half-baked. Because, like you say, he really doesn't do much for the first half of the story. And then it seems like really his only reason for being there in the second half of the story is because they bring in this female character who had been, you know, at this houseboat brothel or whatever, and she joins them on their journey. And so now we have a little bit of a love story, but even that's kind of half baked. There's not much to it.
No, it happens quickly. It's discreet. I don't know that they are supposed to have consummated their relationship, but it seems like that's the implication. But of course, it's very chaste in the way it appears on the screen. The other thing that he is a setup for a punchline in that sequence at the end with the dog. And then mm-hmm. of course, at the very end of the film, there's a heartwarming moment also because of him and the dog.
Yeah. All right. So Strother Martin, I mean, if George Kennedy wasn't stealing the show, he'd be my MVP here. I think his performance is really great. I loved just kind of the childlike innocence of his character in this. He really comes across as, you know, I mean, very much like seeing the world with child's eyes. He's got a prison. He's the one that is dreaming the most about starting this store. And everywhere he goes, he's taking notes about things. You know, it was so charming to me that, like, they're sitting there having breakfast before Jimmy Stewart's going to go off with the dynamite and go to the bank. And he's like asking them, you know, should I ask the waitress about where they get these beans? Because I think we should stock these beans at the store. It's just, you know, again, these wonderful little nuggets that they put into these characters that make them so interesting. But Strother Martin just sells it with just this wonderful childlike approach.
Yeah. There are times when he's a simpleton. And there are other times when he just looks like he is so anxious and nervous. I think he's sweating the whole movie.
Not as much as George Kennedy, but yes.
And the sequence on the houseboat with Ann Baxter was funny. You know, I kind of like the idea that when she discovers he's a bank robber, that she's not going to charge him for the whiskey that she's just poured for him, because
right. –
He's clearly on the right side of things, even though he's a criminal.
Yeah. Well, and one of the other things I love about that sequence is you get the impression like he's such a simpleton that he doesn't even realize where he is and what goes on this boat. You know?
Yeah, no, he seems to be sort of clueless, but he is interested in the the whiskey. He says, I need a drink, you know, and he gets distracted from what the, I mean, they were basically trying to escape from being killed, and he's going to take a refreshment break.
All right. So let's go to George Kennedy now. I think we both said he's really the one that steals the show here. I've been a huge fan of George Kennedy ever since several years ago on the Lambcast. I was a part of a franchise look back where we did the Airport series, which of course, George Kennedy's the one actor that appears in all four Airport films. And ever since then, I've just been like, all right, George Kennedy's my man. And whenever I see him show up in movies, I'm just thrilled. And this might be one of my favorite performances for me. He is so slimy in this.
Oh, it's amazing. And he's got that hat that fits down over his head and practically hides his face. And when he's talking, you can see the hat moving up and down on his head when he's making threatening statements. And he's constantly having to wipe off his little glasses in the rain, trying to be able to see to shoot people. he seems like he's an overmatched villain, but he's got plenty of animosity and creepiness around him to make him a real villain, even though he is a little bit of a comic visual image. And he's wearing those white shoes.
He's making fun of
the guy in the flashy shirt. Who does he think the white shoes are going to impress?
Well, and there's such a contrast in the way that he's presented, you know, because like you say, he's got the little, you know, like John Lennon type glasses and the weird hat and all that stuff. And then, but yet, I mean, he's George Kennedy. He's an imposing figure, you know,
he's a big guy and yeah.
I mean, he's got this kind of nerdy, weaselly look to him, but still, George Kennedy, you know, and then there's the teeth, which just drove me up the wall. So disgusting.
<There's>
The worst teeth
right
in movie history.
Teeth, yes.
No, I'm wondering what's going on in this town that, you know, the teeth are rotten out of his head. It's gross. But yeah, it's a really fun villain performance. He just comes across as so conniving and bloodthirsty too, and then just, you know, the way he kind of covers his tracks on everything by talking about being a Sunday school teacher and, you know, when he takes the money from the bank manager, oh, well, this will help our vacation Bible school.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I want to jump back to one of the things you were saying earlier, just about kind of the, you know, the setting of the film and, you know, kind of this town and the look of things and all that. It's something that I thought they pulled off really, really well, but I'll let you talk a bit more about it here first.
Well, obviously, they filmed it in a part of the world that had probably not changed that much between the 1935 setting and the 1971 or the 1970 production of the film. It's a small town in West Virginia, probably between Ohio and Pennsylvania. And just, you know, it's a small community that nowadays, of course, those communities have mostly died because all of the steelworking that used to take place there has gone away. All the industrial business has vanished. This town seems like it was not really a factory town, but it was just a community that was centered around a small civic area. Mm-hmm. And the small civic area looked like it would be a small town. You know, there's a diner and there's the grocery store and there's the bank right next to it. I think probably the main business in this community was the prison, which
Absolutely.
Is apparently
yeah.
just down the road, you know? So that's why the prison guards and everybody seems to know each other in the town. It looks, like I said, it probably wasn't hard to make it look like it was 1935 because most of the buildings are pretty old. The cars, like you said, at the beginning, they get into that one car and it's a convertible and the four of them plus a driver sitting there. It's funny, and they got the dog sitting in the car with them as well, you know, the bloodhound that belongs to the prison, and they all go riding off, and it's like when the car starts George Kennedy practically loses his hat and has to grab onto it. And he's got the shotgun between his legs, holding it up in the air, you know, pointing it up in the air. And it just looks like something that people would do in those days. You know, let's all pile in the car and bring the dog. And yeah, I've got my shotgun here. And the I like the train sequences. There's a train sequence where they are having to escape the contract killers in the first part of the film. And then there's another train sequence at the end when they're trying to hide from, well, not quite the end, but kind of at the end of the second act, beginning of the third act, where they're trying to hide from George Kennedy's character in a train yard. So it gets a little complicated there. They got fooled, but you also have the idea of homeless people and itinerant travelers as part of the story, and that all feels very real. When they were sitting in the train car on the trip, I thought, yeah, that looks about as uncomfortable as you would find in a train in 1935.
No, I'm right with you. The thought that was going through my mind as I was watching it was, yeah, this looks like a town that probably looks exactly like it did back in 1935 when they shot this in 1971. Nothing had changed, really. And I don't know, it just really added an extra level to me for this. It didn't feel manufactured in any way. I mean, it definitely doesn't look like a backlot or anything like that. It feels like we're actually here in that time. And, you know, also just kind of the people and all the goings on in the town, you definitely get the feel of that Depression era. I mean, I got to admit, there were times when, you know, as various things were unfolding here, I could kind of get in the mindset of, well, I kind of don't blame some of these people for maybe being a little irked that these folks that have been in prison for all these years have $25,000 in their pocket and I'm in the bread line. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's, and that I think is, by the way, the one obvious weakness in this film. There is no way that he would accumulate that much money as a prisoner for 40 years at what they pay prisoners. It would, I mean, that's ridiculous. I looked it up, and in the notes that I saw, that would have been the equivalent of $500,000 in 1935. And you think about what people were earning in those days, how much things were worth, how long it took to accumulate a chunk of change, and you think he was able to save enough money to be half a millionaire in 40 years in prison. I don't know that people outside of prison, if they saved that much, would be able to be in that situation. So that's a little bit – there could have been some explanation that they would – maybe there is something provided in the book that talked about how there is a matching program for prisoners where the state, for every year that they are on good behavior, the state will contribute or – you know, match the amount of money that they've earned that year, then it might make a little bit more sense. But just the idea that, you know, he saved every penny while he was earning, you know, nickels a day, that I think is hard to believe. But I can understand, look, everybody is, it's the middle of the Depression and they're stuck. On the other hand, they are screwing the bank, and the bank, of course, is never going to be the popular civic citizen that everybody looks toward and feels good about, at least unless you're talking about George Bailey, another Jim Stewart movie.
Well, I guess also when it comes to, you know, maybe the things that are a little far-fetched about this, I wonder what your thought is on the ultimate ending of things. I mean, we say it many times here. We don't shy away from spoilers on this show. We're talking about a 53-year-old movie here. There's a part of me that when everything was resolved in the end, though, I was like, okay, yay. I was also kind of like, I don't know if I buy that things turned out good for our heroes in the end.
Well, it in large part depends on that character that we talked about earlier, the train conductor, backing up the story that the three prisoners would be telling against anybody else, including the bank president. Yeah, it would have been nice if there had been some detail at the bank that would give more credence to what had happened and justify how quickly the three prisoners were basically exonerated from doing anything wrong. and given their money and a pat on the back to go on their way. The part where everybody else in the town is celebrating the bank's comeuppance, again, this there could be backstory in the book that talked about how the bank had screwed people over a number of times. Since we know that George Kennedy's character has killed five other people over the years for the bank president, there's something going on, and I'm sure the locals had some suspicion about the bank. So I could see that, but it's not in the story that we're seeing. So I think that's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit quick, but it is ending the way, you know, they're giving us the shorthand version of the good, happy ending.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I mean, it didn't diminish my enjoyment of the film. I thought, you know, overall, I thought this was a very enjoyable film that kind of came out of nowhere for me. And I think a large part of its success is really kind of wrapped up in our lead characters and just the wonderful characters that they're creating here. Like I said, I wanted to spend more time with these guys. I wanted to spend more time with all these characters. You know, I wanted to see the rest of the madam's story. And I want a movie about her. I want a movie about the weird guy with the cowboy hat that goes out killing atheists. You know?
Yeah, all the characters could do with a little bit more. Look, you could turn it into a TV show or a miniseries, or we could have a series of movies based on those characters. We got shows like that. The Waltons was full of those kinds of things where interesting characters would show up in town and interact with the family there, and we'd get a side story about what was going on. You could do that with this movie. Obviously, that's not the point of the movie, but it wouldn't be hard to follow through. And I just don't, you know, it's not one of those things that they would have done in 1971. Nowadays, right. They could do that. They could say, you know what, we can turn this into kind of a rural drama and have all these characters. And I would think that Lee would get to open his store.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, before we take it to break, any closing thoughts you have on this one?
Well, I just think that people forget that the movie exists for obvious reasons. It was never released on DVD. There was a VHS release at one point, but it was also pretty rare. I acquired this a number of years ago in a bootleg that I bought online. I can't tell you what the site was anymore. They did a nice job of it, though, when they did it, but it was clear that it came off of TCM because the TCM logo appears on the print that I have. And I acquired it back when streaming was not really viable. It wasn't practical, and there weren't the streaming services that we have now. Now I understand. I'm sure you must have seen it on Tubi or YouTube or someplace like that.
I watched it on Tubi, you know, which I mean, I feel like Tubi gets brought up every week on this show because it just continues to be one of the best sources for finding the types of films we talk about on this show.
Yeah, and I think I've said it on your show before, and I say it on my show on a regular basis. I'm a physical media guy, and I like to have tangible material that I can count on being there when I want it. And as opposed to, gee, suppose we had been doing this show and you decided to watch, that's the movie that we're going to do, and it's not available anyplace. That would be very frustrating.
It's actually happened before where we planned an episode and then it vanished from all the streaming opportunities and we had to scramble. But such is not the case this time. It's out there on Tubi. I recommend it. I had fun with it.
Good. I recommend it too. Thanks for picking it.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break here. We'll hear from another one of our podcasting friends and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
In a world where podcasts already seem to address every imaginable subject, one man broke new ground with a seemingly random obsession about exploding helicopters in movies. He was a podcaster on the edge, a maverick broadcaster who played by his own rules. Now, he has a last chance to talk about the strange way helicopters explode in film. Exploding Helicopter, available on iTunes and Podomatic now. Think you know about chopper fireballs? Think again.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a quick reminder that you can now help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few measly little old dollars a month, you can support this show and earn access to some bonus features, including a bunch of the old episodes of this show that are no longer available on the main podcast feed. Visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more, and we thank you for your support.
Agent Ryan?
Agent Laverne?
The Rabbit Hole Podcast team has asked us to return back to the town of Twin Peaks to go over all the case files. Are you ready?
Have we been asked to cover the case files of the groundbreaking series created by David Lynch and Mark Frost?
The same one. We will be discussing in detail every episode from all three seasons of the show.
Including the plot of every character, not just the mystery of who killed Laura Palmer.
Exactly. We'll also dive into why the show became such a phenomenon in the 90s and how it still influences shows today.
Will we discuss the feature film Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me?
You know, that may be our longest season yet.
So check Tales from the Double R on Anchor, Spotify, Good Pods, or listen to us at rabbitholepodcasts.com.
Now, let's order some coffee and a piece of that amazing pie.
We've brought back those good old time flavors, and today they're better than ever. All these delicious treats are waiting for you at the refreshment stand. Delicious fresh popcorn, ice cold cola, tasting candy you know and love. They're all ready for you now, so you won't have to miss any of the feature. Come and get them.
Okay, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This, of course, is the part of the show where we get to talk about some more movies, something that we've enjoyed that we want to spread the word about. It could be a forgotten film. It could be an old classic. It could be something new in theaters or on streaming. The possibilities are endless. So, Richard, what is your recommendation?
Well, you know, I'm not going to be recommending a new film. I'm going to be recommending an old classic, of course. And I'm going to be recommending a Strother Martin film. And I want to preface it with a quote that I picked up this week that I thought was very impressive. You know, here's the quote. In the 70s, if you went to the movies all the time, you could expect to see Strother Martin 4 or 5 times a year. And I'm not talking about big showy roles like Cool Hand Luke or The Wild Bunch or Hard Times. But in those roles in movies like this one, in and out. He was always great. He always made you smile. He always left you wanting more. And when he died, he left a hole in American cinema that nobody else can ever replace. Maybe one of the reasons American cinema in the 70s was so great is that because we could expect to see Strother Martin 4 times a year. That was Quentin Tarantino talking about the movie Nightwing, which he screened at his theater in Los Angeles a number of years ago. And this was on the Post talking about that particular film. And I understand, because when I looked, Strother had almost exactly 3 or 4 films a year for the 4 or 5 years before he died. At the beginning of the 70s, though, he had a couple of other films. We talked about We talked about The Brotherhood of Satan.
Yeah.
But I'm going to recommend a movie that ought to be a little bit better known. It's not a great film, but it's an interesting kind of a character piece. It's one of the times that he worked with Paul Newman and Lee Marvin. It's 1972's Pocket Money. In this film...
I haven't seen this one.
Oh, well, it's an interesting film because Paul Newman is kind of an itinerant rodeo cowboy who's struggling to function, and he and Lee Marvin kind of team up to buy horses for a broker down in Mexico that they're going to move up into the States for auctions. And Strother Martin is the broker that kind of hires them to do this. But of course, nothing is straight in this story. People are trying to shortchange our heroes. They're constantly being bamboozled by the local officialdom, by some corrupt character in Mexico, by the broker that they're working with. Wayne Rogers is in this picture along with Strother Martin as kind of his associate. It's like I said, it's not like there's a big important story hero here, but we've got a great bunch of character actors in it. Hector Elizondo's in this. Gregory Sierra. I already mentioned to you that Wayne Rogers is in the film. Matt Clark. A bunch of those character actors that if you were a fan of movies in the 1970s, you would recognize immediately and say, this is a movie that I ought to see. The story is not great. It's not that there's anything exciting that happens, but they're interesting characters. It's a lot of, for me, it was a lot of fun to watch. And I just enjoy these kind of shaggy dog stories.
Well, you sold me when you said Paul Newman as a rodeo cowboy. I was like, oh, that sounds like fun. but yeah, with all these other people in there, that definitely looks interesting. I pulled up the Wikipedia page, too, and I'm looking through the people they have listed in the cast. And at the bottom, they list Terrence Malick as a part in this movie. I don't know if it's a bit part or what. It just says Terrence Malick as Worksman. So who knows?
I think he's like a lot of these things. He was probably a member of the crew and they needed somebody in the background.
Maybe so.
He got a credit.
All right. Well, the movie that I am going to recommend, this is one that I finally got to check off my list a few weeks ago. It's one that I've heard recommended from many people in the past, including Richard. I know he's a fan of this one, and it's a movie where you have a lovable criminal at the center of the story, trying to avoid being caught or killed. I'm going to go to a few years after Fool's Parade, 1973, Charlie Varick, starring Walter Matthau.
Awesome.
Directed by Don Siegel. Matthau, he plays a guy who's a crop duster, former stunt pilot, and he pulls off this robbery of a small bank and ends up kind of over his head because he's got way more money than what he had planned on, because it turns out this little bank in Nevada is a bank where the mob launders their money. So now not only does he have to avoid getting caught by the cops and such, but he's got a mob hitman after him played by Joe Don Baker. I mean, we're talking about actors who I just, when I see they're in a movie, I'm like, all right, yes, strap in. This is going to be good. Walter Matthau is definitely one of them. And this is peak Matthau. He just gives us a lovable crook who you just can't help but root for in this. And like the movie we were talking about here today, this is another one where we've got some really great colorful characters surrounding him, including this wonderfully slimy villain played by Joe Don Baker. He steals the show here as well. And it's also, you know, much like Fool's Parade, I think it's a film that makes good use of its locations. You know, here it's set out in the wide open nothingness of Nevada, you know, small towns, trailer parks, little airstrips in the middle of nowhere. You know, it's all used to great effect. You know, again, a film where it's the story is pretty simple, but it just draws you in. And it's a case where the crooks are the good guys. And it's a very charming film.
And like we said, it's full of those actors from that era that are so interesting and fun to watch. Andrew Robinson, who had previously been Scorpio in the Dirty Harry movie, he was so great in that movie. He's in this movie as Matthau's basically apprentice partner in the film. And you got Cherie North, who's, I swear she was in everything in the 1970s. Norman Fell shows up in the movie at one point.
John Vernon's in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a fun movie. Lots of cool people in that film. Well, Richard, I want to thank you for being on the show. Before I let you go here, please remind everybody of where they can find all the stuff you've got going on.
All right. Well, my personal blog site is Kirkham A Movie A Day. It can be found at kirkham.class.blogspot.com or at kirkhamamovieaday.com. There's a WordPress site and there's a Blogspot site. Easy to find. All you do is just type in my name and it'll show up. Either that or Sensei Richard Kirkham, who is a karate instructor down in Florida. on the Lamcast, my show is up every week with lots of different guests, including Todd on a regular basis. This week we had a What You've Been Watching show that just went up today. Next week, we're going to be covering the new film Argyle. And one of the things I would like to encourage people to do is to visit our YouTube channel where the podcast goes up, but it gets mixed with film clips and pictures from the movies that we're talking about, and assorted visual jokes that I can think of as I'm assembling it.
Excellent. Well, thanks again for being on the show, and I'll be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast. Well, everybody, that's going to do it for this episode of the Forgotten Filmcast. As always, thank you for listening. If you'd like to read more reviews of Forgotten Films, you can find them over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on X, the artist formerly known as Twitter, at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. Of course, we welcome your questions, comments, and feedback about the show, so please email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And while you're at it, you can leave a positive review of the show over at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, don't forget about our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn all about how you can help support this show. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you again next time.
Peas, Maddie, peas. No store's any good without green peas.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.